Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The dollar spikes. Greece is getting a bailout. Number two. The debt ceiling has to be raised, says Geithner, or else we're impending a massive financial disaster. And China cools. Along with that, we have Andrew Ross Sorkin of the New York Times and the author of Too Big to Fail. All this on episode number 212 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, I hope you're doing well. I hope that all things are in your favor right now. We have just a whole litany of great topics to talk about today. I have some apps that I want to talk to you about, some iPad apps. You could probably get them for the iPhone or whatever mobile device you're using. And a few of them that I picked up, I try to go through the app store and figure out what's new, what's different, and what can be used to see if there's something that is worthwhile. So far, in the area of finance and investing, there's a few things. There's some things that come in very handy. I've talked to you about that before. We'll talk about some of the other ones that maybe aren't so handy in a little while. I also wanted to talk to you about some of the things that are happening right now. The big news items that we really need to be paying attention to when it comes to the markets right now. If you haven't noticed, the markets are, well, they're kind of not happy. There's been some good days. There have been some bad days. The bad days have been taking down the good days. But overall, when you look at the S&P 500 and you look at the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones, it's holding pretty steady. Yeah, some drawdown. Behind the scenes, there's been some stocks that have been knocked for a loop between the oil complex over the last couple of weeks and some technology shares recently, and not to mention, of course, the Chinese stocks like the Baidus last week, Sina, Sohu, just got killed. Those aren't even the issues that really got smacked, which were the smaller cap stocks. The Russell 2000 is now below its 50-day moving average. It's also below what we see as our short-term and our longer-term trend signal, which is showing a we'll call it a bear or downtrend. Not a bear market, but a bear trend or a downtrend. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that the various indices and stocks have been able to test some very important support points lately, like the 50-day moving average, like some critical support levels, Fibonacci retracements. These have been coming in very handy in this kind of a sideways market because this getting whipped around back and forth is very difficult if you're not prepared to make a relatively quick move. Now, if you're in the mode to just buy what you got and save it and hold it, all right, we're not talking about that. What we're talking about is the potential for trying to either hedge a portfolio if things are falling and you're long, or making profits on the positions when they are about to break up. Either way you want to look at it, right? So we can try to profit if it's going to be moving towards a resistance point and then falling, or we can try to profit if it's moving down to a support point and it bounces from there. Now, of course, it could blow past resistance or it could drop down right through support. But in this market right now, with the liquidity that we've seen and with investor enthusiasm still in there, the buy and the dip mentality has been, well, pretty solid. I want to make sure I'm clear on this. I don't like the buy and the dip mentality because it's bound to fail sooner or later, oftentimes sooner. But again, with the liquidity that we're seeing right now from the Fed, it appears that there's some room to go. Now, while markets are forward-looking, and oftentimes it's said that they're somewhere about 6 months out, markets are looking. At the same time, with the liquidity, even though it's drying up, let's say at the end of June-ish, between the Fed's liquidity measures and the potential for who knows what happens in Congress when they're trying to possibly increase taxes or pay for the massive amount of debt that they have, you know, accumulated over the last 2 years. Something's going to happen. So what we've seen of late is that this is all coming to a head. And it's really coming to a head as we see the dollar start to move up. Because this whole recent rally, I'll talk about the last 6 months, since QE2, maybe even longer, but since QE2 started, has been all about companies making more profits because they have cheap money, they're able to refinance their debt at very low rates, and on top of that, they are getting very favorable conditions when it comes to the dollar, especially the multinationals. Because the dollar being so low makes their products so much cheaper when they look at that, and the profitability on their earnings is that much greater. So what we see that the dollar fell 15% or so against the euro and tremendously against other currencies. And as a matter of fact, the Chinese yuan is at the highest point it's been in, I guess, a couple decades or a decade or so. So what's happening is that earnings are flowing down to the companies. A lot of people keep on talking about the unemployment rate. And the unemployment rate, while it's a lagging indicator, is still in the front of the vision of the Fed, because their dual mandate says that, well, they have to keep interest rates low, keep inflation under check is the first issue by doing that. And secondly, they have to get maximum employment. The problem is that it's a vicious cycle, isn't it? That as companies need to cut back because of higher expenses, whether it's commodities or whether it's less sales, they need to figure out a way to be lean and mean, right? So what they do is they find every possible and conceivable way to cut back that they can, whether it's from maybe a benefits standpoint, pensions and health insurance, or maybe it's the human factor, which we've talked about 100 times. And we've seen, again, the initial claims in the United States move up for the last 3 weeks over the 400,000 mark, which, you know what? The move below it was only a few weeks. So now there's the concern that even though we saw a good jobs number, which a lot of that had to do with McDonald's a couple of weeks back, the question still remains, is the employment situation going to resolve itself so that we could see higher employment? And if we don't, what does that mean? Well, from this guy's standpoint, and from what we see, it doesn't really matter if the employment is at full capacity, because we're really not just dealing with the United States right now. We're dealing with the whole world. We talked about that with Kevin last week. And the big issue that you really have to contend with here is the whole idea that companies' profitability is just a function of, as simple as it gets, right? Sales versus expenses is income, net income, or EPS, earnings per share, when you calculate it out. So the whole discussion brings us right back to the dollar, because the dollar has been strengthening. As a matter of fact, the dollar has moved up by about 6%, 5.8% to be exact, over the last week and a half against the euro. Now, here's the rub. There has been it's more than tremendous. It's an enormous amount of shorting of the dollar, buying of the euro, or any other currency for that matter, or even using the dollar as an alternative carry trade. So the carry trade usually is with currency, but I do believe that we're seeing just an extraordinary amount of dollar selling to buy things like commodities, stocks, etc. Now, what does that mean? Well, we've talked about this, but here's the proof in the pudding. When you see the dollar starting to move higher, and the correlation we know already of the dollar to other assets, particularly commodities, oil, gold, silver, has been extremely high. And when the dollar starts moving higher against the euro, a lot of players are bailing out, buying back their dollars so they don't get killed, they take their profits. But yet what they need to do is, in a very quick fashion, they need to sell out of the other side of the trade. And when they sell out of the other side of the trade, on top of the CME exacerbating the problem with raising margin limits or requirements and maintenance requirements and initial requirements on, let's say, gas or gold or silver, it creates a a real quick panic. Not only do you have margin requirements going up, and if the material or commodity starts dropping, you have the situation where there's going to be selling automatically done if they don't do it themselves. But then you have the secondary problem that the selling is again brought on by the dollar move. So this is what the wild and crazy action of the last few weeks with silver, with oil, gasoline, has been all about. Now, silver has a little game of its own. We've talked about this. And hopefully you took the ideas that we had a few weeks ago and utilized them, whether it's through options or through the ETFs or shorting or selling some of your silver holdings. If you're a silver bull, I'm certain you didn't sell it, because you're never going to sell it ever until it gets so painful that you can sell it at the wrong time. That's usually what happens. It happens to all of us. I don't care if you're a professional or an amateur. Sometimes that capitulation point just comes just at the wrong time. I'll give you an example. Last week, we had a stock that we really liked, and it was a small holding for our portfolios, but we listened to the conference call, or at least the part of the conference call and the key components of it, looked at the numbers, looked at the outlook, and we said, wow, this company, Spreadtrum Communications, that makes some of the materials for devices, et cetera, mobile devices, boy, they're looking pretty good. You know, they're looking better than I thought, but the previous week or 2 weeks, there was a lot of distribution going on, a lot of selling into any of the strength. The earnings come out, stock starts moving up, and, you know, you look at it and you say, you know what, I agree with this right now because things look good, but you don't want to fight the tape. Stock rolls over hard. It rolls over harder. Down maybe 8% at this point. I said, you know what, we have a small position. Let's cut most of it out, if not all of it out right now, till we can see what's going on and who the players are, because the volume's up. Even though we saw all the numbers look pretty solid, and we even dug down to it and it looked pretty solid, there must be something else behind the scenes. Maybe is one of the mobile providers not utilizing them in the future that we're not seeing? What's happening here? Well, we really couldn't find anything, but still the tape was telling us we got a weakening market, we got distribution, we have high volume selling, we have the stock crossing below all of its trending movements and its various moving averages, the important ones. It's really time to step aside. Well, right about that point, we sold it. It went down another 5 or 6%. Okay, so far so good. You know what? It turned around about 2.5, 3 days later and went up about 8%. Now, don't tell me that hasn't happened to you. It happened to everybody. Now, listen, bounces are one thing. We'll see what happens and reevaluate. And one of the other things that happens is that when you sell out a lot of times, you don't want to get back in because you don't want to get burned, right? Think about it. How many times have you sold out of something because you were just fed up, or you decided it wasn't a good idea, or whatever the reason is, and the stock starts turning around, but you don't buy back into it? No, because it burned you once, burned you twice, you don't get back into it. You take these preconceived notions and you kind of let them rule your situation. Don't let that happen to you. If we can buy Crocs for our clients, and if you've been longtime listeners, you know what I'm talking about. We were one of the original Crocs haters. One of the ones that were bashing Crocs because of the incredibly overvaluation of their shares in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But we bought Crocs a few weeks ago, first time in years. First time they actually ended up on one of our screens that we utilize that is very, very extremely strict on earnings growth and on historical consistency of a stock, on things like ROE and balance sheet, debt, things of that nature. So I think that lesson learned, you don't buy every bounce, but you look at them as opportunities to say, hey, do I need to reevaluate my situation? And where is it that I'll get back into this? Now, that's a long story all the way back to the whole idea of the dollar bouncing here and the question whether or not it's going to be a continued move into safe haven assets because of what we're seeing around the world, particularly in Greece, which we're going to get to in 1 second. I have some comments about that. Or is this going to be a short-term situation, realizing that we still have another couple of months left on the QE and the dollar is not being helped by anybody and not desirous by anybody, and we'll see just a turnaround and a move higher, which will then drag the markets higher. So this recent move, we think, though, that this recent move of the dollar is warranted. If you look at any of the charts, we did a lot of technical analysis on the dollar. And if you look at a channel study, if you look at things, even things like stochastics and RSI, and you look at all these different conditions, they're screaming oversold on the dollar. Now, does that mean that it can't get more oversold? Well, no. We've seen oversold on the dollar before. What it does mean, though, is the conditions are ripe for the dollar to move up. It means that if things are set up in a way that we have this flight to safety, there is going to be more so of an opportunity to get long the dollar because there's going to be a short squeeze coming. Already a 6% move on the euro versus the dollar is, I think, pretty much a pretty high quality short squeeze already. And again, it's all predicated on the fact that the euro is under pressure because Greece, now a country that said they had their things under control, their austerity measures were working, that the prime minister comes out and says, hey, things are great. We got it going. It's all good. We realize there's an emergency meeting going on in Luxembourg last week that said that, well, maybe it's not as good as we thought it was. In fact, we need about $100 billion. $100 billion. That's part two. Because Greece is unable to meet the demands of their expenses with the tax receipts and the income they have coming in from various areas. And they can't meet the current price rates or the yield requirements that the world wants on buying their bonds. No kidding. We talked about that with Das how many times? We've talked about that so many. It's going to be inevitable. There's going to be a restructuring. But the problem with the restructuring, again, as we talked about, is that it hurts a lot of people. But you can't just have candy and expect not to get fat. You can't expect to jump off the top of a building and expect not to get hurt. You know, the fact is that there needs to be something done, and somewhere along the line, there's going to be pain. I don't know where, whether it's going to be in the European Union that's going to be falling apart because the rumors were out that Greece was going to actually withdraw from the European Union, whether it's going to be that Portugal is also going to need additional money and we're going to see Spain start to have some problems. Whatever it may be, the reality is that austerity, even Krugerman from the New York Times agrees with this, that austerity is just not good for growth. Well, no kidding. We all know that. I mean, come on, it doesn't take any kind of degree in anything to figure out that if you have austerity, an economy is not going to grow. Or at least it's going to grow at a very, very slow pace. Greece is back into a recession again, by the way. Italy is following up next. The UK looks like just garbage. Really, the centerpiece of the whole entire area is Germany. Germany has and has set themselves up to be a major exporting nation, and they've done a stellar job, truly stellar job. Unemployment looks great. GDP looks great. Their industrial production looks terrific. I mean, we're seeing some numbers that look fantastic. We just did a full country analysis on Germany, and it looks like, you know, what are they doing in the middle of Europe? It seems like it's one of those up-and-coming, growing Asian countries. Looks great. But this whole issue with them having to support the entire region is getting a little old to much of the people that are paying the taxes in Germany. Protests are breaking out against Merkel, and no kidding, because they're already going to have to agree to something. They can't let Greece go. They just can't do it because it will be a giant domino. Now, on top of that, we have Geithner coming out and saying that catastrophe is going to strike if we don't raise the debt ceiling. I don't know how you feel about this, but from a practical matter, practical, not a mathematical equation, practical. They're going to have to raise the debt ceiling. It's just the way it is. They're going to do it. We're going to hear the bitching and moaning and the crowing and the people going back and forth politically, slamming each other, blaming each other. They're going to raise it. If they don't raise it, there's going to be a major, major problem, because what you'll have is more so than we have now. if you can imagine this, more so than we have now, what you're going to have is countries around the world saying, you know what? We don't have the faith, the belief in the U.S. dollar anymore and the backing of the U.S. government. And we want even more than ever to have a gold standard. We want to have more than ever a alternative currency. Maybe that's a basket, and no longer have commodities priced in dollars, etc. That just makes sense. So they're not going to let this happen. And at the same time, what we're seeing is that the rhetoric about when this will expire, which is next week, and they could possibly extend it till August or so, is firing up. Now, my hope is, by the way, that this thing does go through, because I'll tell you something. If they start stalling this after the commentary that Geithner has and Bernanke had about catastrophic financial ruin and the potential for a double dip slash new recession, if they dilly-dally around with this thing, there's going to be some head-scratching going on and some real concern. Already, Bill Gross and a few others are there shorting the Treasury bond, the long-term. Already, China is clearly diversifying. Mexico is diversifying from U.S. assets. China has slowed down their buying of U.S. treasuries. And the bottom line is, when you look at all this together, they have really no choice but to increase it. Now, how you feel about that and what that means, the question is, can they restrain themselves? And I hear you all yelling back at me, no, we know they can't. Congress is just made to spend money. Can they increase this for the sake of the practicality of increasing it, but yet at the same time build in some savings and cuts? That's where we're going to have to find out where the rubber meets the road, and if these guys can really do something that is beneficial rather than just trying to pour on more stimulus. Now, over in kind of switching over for a moment to let's go over to China for a second. We saw some numbers come out last week, and we have some more this week. China, from the Chinese numbers that came out, is slowing a bit. Their inflation is increasing. Their retail sales are slowing. Mind you, they're still in the 17% range year over year, okay, for the quarter. So I'm not crying for them. Housing prices starting to stabilize a little bit, and we're seeing industrial production slow a bit. And that's starting to spook some people. At the same time, we're seeing an additional slowdown in Europe. We're seeing that countries around the world in Asia, Latin America, are actually putting the brakes on. India is like putting not only the brakes on, they're putting the emergency brakes on in terms of raising interest rates and banking rates. China again raised rates requirements on their banks last week. So everything is being done. It's kind of really ironic. Everything's being done around the world to actually pull in and stop growth. Well, we're sitting here blathering that we want to increase growth. Who's right? Now, hopefully it's all right, right? You know, hopefully it all works together. That's the big game, the big bet, the big gamble that's being made right now. And what's happening is that markets are caught in between. They're caught in the middle of all this. Over the years, we know the saying 100 times over that the thing that markets hate more than anything else is confusion. Markets do not like confusion. They like direction, absolutes, and answers. When you start having uncertainty and confusion all wrapped up into one, where you don't know what's going on in Japan, now all of a sudden there's a miraculous finding that, wow, it was a lot worse than we thought. The nuclear situation is a lot worse than we thought. We didn't know. Now they're saying that the nuclear rods are fully exposed, and we're seeing, like we said, radiation show up around the world. We're seeing that Europe is saying, wow, it's a lot worse than we thought. You know, woo, maybe we have to do more. We're seeing in America, we're saying, wow, the housing situation, a lot worse than we thought. A lot worse, by the way. Housing prices were down another, I think, close to 3% year over year. We're at the lowest point we've been since the bust, since the top to the bottom. We're at the bottom. So there's all this uncertainty going on, questioning whether we have inflation or not, because they use inflation measures one way, we use it another way. They're saying they want to raise rates. We're saying we want to keep rates low. All of this is happening at once. One of the reasons that we saw materials like precious metals go up so nicely was because of all the confusion. One of the reasons we see stocks going up so much is because of the liquidity and corporate profits. Well, if we have confusion that is continuing and we see corporate profits that are continuing but liquidity not, You may balance the equation a little bit and take away from the materials and take some profits there and look to opportunities when and if there are so in the markets. One such opportunity that is not there that we have to talk about for a minute from the what is up with that department is Microsoft. I can't even get it out of my mouth. Microsoft buying Skype for $8.5 billion. Now, you really, when you heard it, come on, you were wondering, really? Is that, how does that work? Let me see. It fits in because Microsoft is going to integrate it to, that's not right either. All right, there's a lot of product overlap. Nope, not product overlap either. Okay. Well, it must be something that we don't know. Well, the market spoke and they don't like the deal. I don't know anybody that likes the deal. On DH Unplugged last week with John Dvorak, we talked about it, and he doesn't like the deal. Or we don't understand the deal. And even when you look into the deal, it's like, well, they couldn't do anything better with their money than buy Skype and pay top dollar for it. Skype isn't making money, by the way. It has a lot of overlap users, and they have overlap products. But the overlap products, you have to wonder how that's going to integrate. Was it so important that they couldn't build for, I don't know, $4 billion their MSN Messenger into a Skype-like process? Or is it just an admission of how absolutely uncool Microsoft products are? That they couldn't come up with building this and then for another $4 billion spend on an ad campaign. You had $4 billion to build it, $4 billion for an ad campaign. You still save yourself $500 million. But that's just me. All right, what I thought we'd do now is let's get Andrew Ross Sorkin on the line. And then when we finish up that discussion, I want to talk to you about some apps. I want to talk to you about the head of the IMF, what's going on there, and the potential for some pricing power on companies and what's going on there. So before we do that, though, I just want to mention GoToMeeting. They sponsor the show. And, you know, GoToMeeting is one of these great products that, by Citrix, by the way. I don't know if you've seen that stock. It's doing great, or has been doing great. But Citrix GoToMeeting allows you to just easily, I mean, without any pain, agony, or any kind of major installation at all, share your desktop with Microsoft. Should have bought them. It seems like a better fit now that I think about it. Maybe they will. Anyway, you could share your desktop with anybody so that you can actually have a meeting, like you open up a PowerPoint presentation, or you just want to like give a teaching lesson tutorial. I do this with my son, for example, when we're doing, a lot of times we're learning about biology. Well, we'll do a quick GoToMeeting, and I'll have, even though we're in the same room, by the way, sometimes, what we'll do is we'll go over the online book and talk about it and circle things and highlight things. And it's just an amazing tool where you could use it for home. You could use it for business. It's so easy, and anybody could use it at any time. And it's, listen, if you haven't tried it, there's some great applications. Like I said, when I started using it for a learning exercise with my son, I was like, "Wait, this is the best, because we could just look at the things at the same time. We could look at quizzes together. We could study together. He could do it himself. I can then look at what he did after." It's just really neat. So GoToMeeting, all sorts of great applications. You can get it for 30 free days, just an absolutely free, unlimited online meetings for free, just by going to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and enter the promo code PODCAST. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code PODCAST. All right, now after we said that we were going to have him a few times, and he kind of, a few things happened. Andrew Ross Sorkin from the New York Times is here, also a frequent guest and commentator on CNBC, as well as the author of the book, Too Big to Fail, and coming very shortly, the movie. You know, I'm sorry, Andrew, by the way, I'm sorry I couldn't play that part that you'd asked me to for the movie.
I know, yeah. I know. You know, Curtis Hanson, the director, was very upset about that. We had to get a whole casting director involved to try to find somebody else. What a mess. But thank you for considering it. I know your agent passed, yeah. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, so let's talk about a few things. Your book, Too Big to Fail, which was a big piece. It's heavy. It's big. It's because it has a lot of unbelievable insight into the whole banking mess that went on. And you were so embroiled in that. That was like a 24/48/7 kind of thing going on, right? Back then, right?
Oh, no. I mean, it was I still think it was the most important moment in our economic history, at least in the past, 50, 60 years, if not in the past century. I mean, I think that September of 2008 is one of those moments that we will be studying for many, many years, and that's why, HBO spent time trying to turn the book into a film.
Yeah. So one of the things I want to ask you is, in the book, you were so detailed and you had so many conversations that were quoted. As right. I was reading it, I was like, how did you know that? How did you know that stuff?
Right. So I spent about a year interviewing over 200 of the principals for over 500 hours. And I would literally sit with my tape recorder for hours and hours and hours. And I would literally ask, the big issue questions, but I'd also ask the little issue questions. What were you eating? What were you doing at the time? What'd you say to him? How did he say it back? And I would literally compare the notes and go back and forth between all the participants. And oftentimes, if there were if there were 10 people in the room, I would talk to 9 of them,
right?
If not 10.
Right.
And so you were really to recreate what happened in the room. And to me, in retrospect, it's very easy to sort of decide who's wearing the white hat and who's wearing the black hat and what you think of history. But I think when you can get inside the room, when you get behind the headlines, when you can actually see what people were saying and doing and understand the decisions that were being made and what the opportunities were, meaning, what was on offer. Oftentimes today, I think we look back and we're upset about this or that, but it's often a false choice.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually see what the choices were that were available at the time, I think it may change your perspective.
Yeah. So, I think you were young at the time. You're young now. I think you graduated to college at 13 or something, right?
Not Doogie Howser, but I graduated in 1999.
Okay, well, 1999. So the thing is, you were still, really, you were young, and you were. I mean, you're a very bright guy. I'm not trying to butt you up here, but
and you were
able to actually get into that quote unquote club. Right. Obviously, you had credentials behind you with the Times and all that, but you really got some. Just unfettered access to a lot of that, but. Looking back on now you got the book out. Back on it from this point right now, do you think that there's kind of this clear sailing that is being told to us by many of the powers that be, or is there the banking system still a mess?
Oh no, not at all. I think that the banking system is a disaster.
Yeah.
I think the too big to fail is too big to fail squared. You look now, top 10 banks control 75% of all banking assets. Think about that.
Yeah.
I think the Dodd-Frank legislation does, I don't want to say next to nothing, but really only gets at the issues around the edges. We still are living with too big to fail.
Yeah.
But I would say that the greatest lesson, actually, this whole project, in a way, is not only that these firms are too big to fail, but that ultimately, because I look at this as a human drama and as a story about people, they're too big to manage.
Mm.
That's the problem, actually.
Right.
When you think of institutions that are this disparate, with this many products, with this many complicated things going on, the idea that one individual who's the CEO is going to somehow understand it, or frankly, a dozen people on the board or even in the management committee is going to really be able to appreciate all these various issues, it's impossible. And there's some great CEOs who came up through the trading side. They understand trading. They don't understand banking. There's some great people who've come through the banking side, understand banking. They don't understand trading. There's some people coming through the wealth management side who are great marketers. I'm not sure they understand banking or trading.
Right.
It's a really complicated thing. I was with, I was up at GE, I don't know when this was, 6-8 months ago, and I was thinking to myself, there are 17 board members at GE, and I know it's not a financial services company, though obviously half of it almost became one with GE Capital. And you think to yourself, this is a company that has 287,000 employees around the world. There's 17 people on the board.
Right.
Do you actually think these 17 people could possibly understand what's happening inside this company?
Well, and top it off,
it's impossible.
What's really interesting is that we always talk about the Fed and all that. We talk about Bernanke, he's the only one doing anything. He's the only. I mean, there's an entire group, more than a group. I mean, teams and teams of people at the Feds and all that that are providing information. But I want to skip over to something, because back in the day when the banks were doing what they were doing, and we were all about, and still are all about, a confidence game, making sure the stress tests look good and making sure that this guy didn't fail and making sure that, AIG didn't fail because then Goldman would fail, et cetera. That is being played out right now in Europe, don't you think?
Oh, I think it's being played out in Europe. And by the way, forget about the banks. It's being played out in Europe on a much grander scale. When I started this project and this book, I remember going to the editors talking about this phrase, too big to fail. They actually thought it was a bad idea for a title of a book. Now we use that phrase in the context not of financial institutions, but but countries in Europe. And that's where this is, you know, and it's a debt problem. It's the same problem. In a way, it's sort of the banking problem on steroids. So yeah. I look at the European problem as the problem today.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a prelude for what ultimately could be our problem.
Well, I'll mention this last point. I know we have limited time, but one of the things that really troubled me last week, there was actually a clear and I think concise a summary of what was going on. When we hear, for example, Portugal says we don't need a bailout, and 3 days later they get a bailout. And you know, this whole BS game that goes on, clearly that there was no meeting in, I think it was Luxembourg, to talk about what was going to happen with Greece, and nobody, you know, we're not meeting at this time, and they shaped their words just right to throw everybody off the track.
And that goes back to the confidence issue that you're talking about.
Right.
And everybody's so desperate to keep the confidence that they're willing to lie.
Right, which, by the way, is going to end up in no confidence, right?
Well, it's interesting. I get the joke. Having worked on this project, I'll tell you, go back to pre-September 2008 and go back to the idea that people were talking about, you know, Dick Fuld played by Billy Crudup in the movie, Tim Geithner. this is how screwed up my head is.
Right.
But, you know, Dick Fuld went to Tim Geithner and said, please make me a bank holding company. This is back in July. Remember, by the way,
right.
Of course, this is what we did to Goldman and Morgan Stanley later. If you asked Tim Geithner today, why wouldn't he allow him to do it? Because he thought it would undermine confidence.
Right.
He thought it would raise a red flag. So there's a big problem, which is, you know, we all think we want transparency. We think we do, and as a journalist, by the way, that's all I'm about. And yet, there is a sense that if you tell the public too much, you can actually only make it worse.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So here's the thing, and you talk about something that leads me right into my next question for you. By the way, when does the movie come out on HBO?
May 23rd, set your DVR, 9 p.m., and then it's going to be repeated, throughout the month on HBO and on demand.
And maybe on your iPad, they have the new iPad app.
HBO Go,
yeah.
If you have that, absolutely.
So question for you, and we'll kind of, I think this is really important. This is a pet peeve of mine, and it's a real problem because one of the things that you talk about is transparency, but it appears to me that there's been a dramatic change in the area of news and journalism, where it's okay to get anonymous quotes from people familiar with the situation. In the old days, I remember you had to get one or two conflicting or at least corroborating witnesses, if you will, on the subject, and then it had to be vetted, et cetera, blah 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 blah. But these days, we get this kind of, I think it's a testing of the water so that it can be pulled. So the news is being used as a propaganda machine, frankly, in some cases. Do you think that's this anonymous thing has gotten out of hand?
Complicated question, because I've relied on anonymous sources for a lot of my reporting, and I've ultimately felt comfortable with it, but I do spend an enormous amount of time doing what you talked about in the beginning, which is that I think in a previous generation, reporters, you know, had a number of sources that were trying to corroborate each piece of information so that you weren't publishing propaganda, as you just described it. I think that actually the sort of emergence of the internet, the democratization of the internet, and the idea that anyone can say anything, and really sort of the increased competition among electronic media has actually created a bit of a conundrum around anonymous sources, because mm-hmm. people are more and more willing to go with early stage stuff. I'll give you a great example. Just this week, we reported it, right? Microsoft bought Skype.
Oh, yeah, that was early, right? When it came out.
Right, $8.5 billion.
Right.
Okay, and we had real sources and multiple sources to get that story in the paper. However, a blog, to their credit, I guess, earlier that day had published a anonymous piece speculating that Microsoft was going to buy Skype and said that they had an inside source, but they didn't really know and weren't really sure, but they're going to throw it out there just in case.
Right.
It's a different standard. Now, to his credit, this guy got it right. It was just as possible he could have gotten it wrong.
Right.
And that's sort of the issue.
And the reason why most people didn't believe it, by the way, when it came out from the blog,
right,
was because it's such a crap deal that it was hard to believe.
There's an element of truth there, too.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, author of Too Big to Fail, and little old me, thinks that the potential for a more permanent position on television is in the wings, but don't say anything. I think that the CNBC grooming.
I love, you know what? Let me say this out loud. I love what I do every day in print, And I love what I get to do in the morning with the folks on Squawk Box.
Yep. You do a great job. And also, he also writes for the New York Times in the
Deal Book, which is you know, my baby.
Yep, absolutely. The Deal Book is great. Great stuff there. Watch his movie. Check out his book. And I appreciate us finally getting together, my friend.
Hey, thank you so much.
All right, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Well,
that was great. That was great. You know what I did? On this week's show notes, by the way, all the show notes, all the information that you want to find about each show on The Disciplined Investor is available on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And just to let you know, it's not just there, that site, to house the podcast. We write about things all the time. If you would have been paying attention a few weeks ago and you've been reading that, you wouldn't have been the first to know about our idea to short silver. We talk about stocks. We talk about the economy, charts that you can use. You got to see some of the charts that we put up. I think we put up some of the best economic charts that you'll find anywhere. Seriously. Easily understandable, trending, showing what's happening, talking about various components. So check out The Disciplined Investor. You could also, if you want to get a more, an immediate notification, you can go over to Twitter or Facebook, but Twitter, and you can actually go to Andrew Horowitz. Just sign up under Andrew Horowitz. And when we blog something, we put something up there, whether it's this podcast or whether it's something we're talking about, it automatically will get shoved over right to Twitter, and you'll get an immediate alert about that. So you should do that also. I think that would be very helpful. The thing I want to talk about before we went to Andrew Sorkin is a couple of things. First of all, I mentioned that his book is great. The movie, you got to see the trailer. We put the trailer on the site. That's what I want to mention. We put the trailer on this episode's, it's about 40 seconds or something like that. Great actress, by the way. You got to check it out. This is going to be great. It's coming up, next week? But we were talking about how there is a couple of things. There's pricing power of companies that are, I think, very important to take a look at. And what does that mean for the future, right? So we look at the fact that there's a big concern out there that input pricing, input costs due to inflationary reasons are starting to creep into the margins and create problems for companies. I'll give you an example. So you look at Chipotle. This is a great chain, an unbelievable growth company that just keeps on growing, by the way, expanding, has a new Asian concept out. They're expanding worldwide, and we've been very concerned about their margins. Actually, not this quarter, but last quarter, we actually shorted their shares and made, I think, about 8 or 9% on the short. It's one of those stocks you got to be careful of because everybody loves Chipotle, and it turned around, and we got out of it and saved ourselves from the upside. This quarter, they come out, and they're talking about, again, margin compression, concerns about the high cost of food. They're not really going to be increasing their menu prices for another quarter. But lo and behold, something happened. There's an announcement that they're increasing their menu prices. Okay. Food prices are still up. April's numbers from the UN was at the highest ever. But all of a sudden, the end of April comes and May comes and food prices start moving down. Now, Chipotle stock was under pressure because there was a real big concern about the continuation of food price escalation, and they're going to have, obviously, margins cut, and they're also going to have lower earnings. But now they're able to do something interesting. They're increasing pricing and assume that the customer will, let's assume that the customer will actually pay that. And when they do that, and at the same time, pricing of the input cost actually goes down, that's a double benefit. Take a look at the stock, CMG. Done very well. We don't own it right now, but done very well recently on this thesis. Starbucks announced last week they're stopping buying coffee. No kidding. I had to read it myself when I heard about this. They're stopping buying coffee because the price is too high. Well, they stop buying coffee and the demand isn't there. Prices should, in theory, drop. Now you got weather conditions. You got all sorts of different things that go into this, but you know, what happens is that there is the potential for a lot of companies who have been increasing pricing on various materials, like some of the chemical companies, Eastman Chemical, Albemarle, DuPont, to actually benefit if we do see prices start to drop due to the fact that this inflationary pressure, because of the growth of the emerging markets and the dollar moving up in value recently, is going to possibly subside. I want you to take a look at that. Very interesting concept to think about, okay? I also want to talk about this whole issue of this news breaking over the weekend about the head of the IMF is taken off a plane because he is accused of sexual assault, rape, whatever exactly it is. It's not good. Of a woman who was about 32 years old in a Manhattan hotel room. He's in his 50s, I believe. Now, this is a guy who is the head of the International Monetary Fund. This is the guy that was getting on the plane. Do you know why he was getting on the plane, by the way? He was going over to Brussels. That's where they're having the meeting on Monday, the 16th, to talk about the Greek bailout. This is a major player in this deal. And maybe he's going to be able to teleconference or do a go-to-meeting or something from jail, unless he gets some unbelievable bond. But there is now a major cloud over his ability to negotiate, right? There is a major problem here now because all of a sudden the IMF is badly tarnished with this. And I talked to a few colleagues of mine about this, and I said, you know, what is it that is going on around here? It's like a circus. One person said it was a circus. It's a fiasco. It's like Caligula is what it is with some of these upper-ups who are thinking they could just lie about everything, cheat, steal. Again, look at some of the European countries that have just been outright lying about what's going on with their economies. You know, one day they say, we don't need a bailout. Next day they say, we need a bailout, and so on and so on. So I think that we have to start reestablishing a little bit more of a trust from the people in charge, because even as early as, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, there was a gentleman going to a meeting, the emergency meeting that never happened, on the rumor that Greece was going to be bailed out or pulled out of the EU that never supposedly was happening, and outright told a reporter that he was lying or that he was making things up or distorting the truth so that people wouldn't panic. Now, how much and how deep does that go? Doesn't that bother you? That we're just being led around like puppets? That we can't get the information that we need to make an appropriate decision? That Europe is just hiding all their misery inside $1 trillion of debt assurance? That just goes on and on. We could gripe about that for a long time, but at the same time, that's just miserable things we're talking about. There's still some good things happening in the U.S. I don't know about the jobs market or some of the eco, but I got to tell you, there are some companies making a fortune on the growth of the emerging markets, in particular with technology. Now, Apple's been one of the players, the main players in this. They recently came under pressure. You know, they say when Apple falls, the market's going to fall, or at least comes down or breaks, the market's going to break. It doesn't have to go far. It just has to go. Apple has broken its 50-day moving average. Doesn't happen that often. It broke its 50-day moving average Friday on very light volume comparatively. Okay? It's a warning signal. Why is Apple being sold? We know why it was being sold a couple of weeks ago, because of the rebalance of the NASDAQ 100. Why is it being sold now? What's going on? I don't think there's anything in particular. I just think there's a major requirement for liquidity. I think hedge funds are getting themselves slammed against the wall with these commodity trades. The dollar move has just killed them, and they're having to do a forced sale. And this forced selling is creating a need to grab the most liquid securities like an Apple, like a Google, like a Baidu, like a, you know, IBM for that matter, whatever it is. And they're having to liquidate this stuff now in order to make sure they have the backing for the money they lost on that major decline in silver, in gasoline over those few days, and on oil. So the next area we need to look at for Apple, very important to take a look, get your alerts ready, is 339. Now, 339 on Apple will give you two things. First, it gives you a point that is still below its 50-day moving average, very important. It also gives you a break of our, we'll call it, short-term trend changer, right? So when the trend changes, and when we look at the support levels, about 339 and a little bit, but 339, round number, is the number you need to look at. Very important. Because if it breaks there, it's clearly showing a signal that there is more than just a market sell-off going, that, you know, there is a lot more selling and liquidity driving and the requirement to move out of equities than just a couple of days. When the leader like Apple that comes in with stellar earnings, stellar outlook, yeah, some supply issues, but price tags, I don't know, all over the 420 to 480 zone from analysts. When it starts breaking down, you really got to pay attention to the overall market. It is one of those leading indicators of the market that you need to look at, because basically every mutual fund, every hedge manager, every investor, a lot of ETFs own a piece of Apple. So when Apple starts rolling, it's kind of like a real market sentiment changer. And realize that, you know, the next stop you have below there is about 10 bucks down from there or so. Not a big deal, 3, 4%. But still, be aware of this. Be very aware of what's going on and the change in that. And more importantly, that Apple's 50-day moving average is starting to flatten out and just ever so slightly start to move and slope lower. So those are things you really need to pay attention to. I think it's, you know, when we look at Apple, when we look at the markets, when we look at the trends, right now, the Russell 2000 is in a downtrend. Now, I don't mean that to be just very, say, a downtrend. It is in a classical, what we call a short and long-term downtrend. That doesn't mean it can't turn, but it's below every signal. It's below all the support. We are actually short the Russell right now. Now, we move in and out of it as a hedge, but we are short the Russell 2000 right now while being long our strongest stocks. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are still both in a short-term and long-term trend. Now, there are a lot of players that are saying, hey, we're in a downtrend because this, 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 and this. Well, when you take in consideration all those circumstances, well, we still have a clear uptrend, or at least a sideways trend going on, not a downtrend for the other two. Now, quickly before we go, I just want to mention, let me just pull up my iPad here because I got a couple of apps that I think you may want to look at, or maybe not. I don't know. They're back and forth on what's good and what's not here. All right. So I told you about the CNBC app. That was good. I told you about the Bloomberg app. That was good, right? Okay, great. How about there's an app from Yahoo called Market Dash. Not sure why they put this one out. Basically, what it is you can put a list of stocks in and you put it in as a watch list and you click on them. I'm doing it right now. And it tells you what the symbol did. It tells you some news and that's it. Don't waste your time. If you want to get it, it's free, but don't waste your time. Two more I want to share with you. There's one from the IMF. Speaking of the IMF, there's one from the IMF that has a, it's all sorts of discussions, news. It has facts. It has information about the IMF fact books. And if you're interested in world economics and you're interested in the, you know, what's out there in terms of studies, what's out there in terms of, you know, maybe country statistics, et cetera, really cool stuff. So you can look at it, for example, and they have things that it's called a WEO, World Economic Outlook. There's news in here, and you can click through here, and what's news from Mongolia, and really, really cool stuff. They have some videos in there, et cetera, et cetera. And you can probably see a picture of the fellow that's going to jail. But anyway, just look up IMF. And then the other one that I want to share with you this week is from PIMCO. If you follow PIMCO, you know, the world's largest bond investor, there is it's kind of like an RSS feed that's built for a portable device. But basically, it will show you, for example, categories. You can look up investment outlook and economic outlook from the various players that are out there. Bill Gross just wrote something called the Kane Mutiny, for example. You can go through all the different writings of all the different players over at PIMCO. Very nicely put together, free. And I think those are three that you could check out. Next week or the week after, we'll try to talk about a few more. I picked up the EIBD, which was interesting, and I'll share that with you, and I'll talk about that. Plus, I have two more economic and one newspaper that I'm not really fond of how they set it up. But we'll talk about that more. If you have any great apps and you want to share with me, any iPhone or iPad, that's what I have. If you want to share with me an Android app, anything that you want, do me a favor, just send it over to me over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I'll take a look at it, and maybe we can see about how it works and if it's good. They're coming out slowly, more and more, and kind of search around for all the different things that are available. But I think that there's some really good ones out there that are making it much easier to deal with understanding markets, seeing things in real time, and a lot of them are very, very cheap. All right, until next week. We have John Perkins coming up. I think I told you about that. And, we have a few different guests that are coming up that are going to be great. The author of Market Wizards. And I think that we're going to have an interesting week with economics and the European situation on the docket, as well as Congress battling it out. I would venture to say that we're going to have a bit of a rock'em sock'em market, depending on every single news item that we do see. Plus, we have Hewlett-Packard and a few other big boys reporting next week. So that should be very interesting as well. And not to mention, obviously, the real stinker that Cisco put up last week. And if you haven't read the information I put up about the conference call, you really need to do so. Go over to disciplineinvestor.com, look up Cisco, and I listened to this conference call. It was dour at best. John Chambers was pretty negative. Anyway, check that out. We'll see you next week. I appreciate you joining me here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Have a profitable week. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.